Well, good evening. My name is George Gillum. I chair the Miller Center Forum, and I'm delighted to welcome a really large, I must say surprisingly large, group out tonight. I don't know if it's the topic. I don't know if it's the promise of A's for the semester that each one of these professors has put out, people trying to get in out of the rain, or the promise of pizza and soft drinks at the end of this. But for whatever reason, we are glad you're here and hope you look forward to this discussion as much as we do. This is going to be a fairly freewheeling, fairly loosely organized discussion of race and gender in politics, with a particular focus on the current presidential election. And what better laboratory have we ever had to look at the way these issues are going to be playing out than this year's election? The participants on the panel are four professors from the politics department: Lynn Sanders, Paul Friedman, Veshla Weaver, and Nick Winter. And then from the Department of Psychology, Brian Nosek. And as I said, the topic that they will be considering, each has done some pretty sophisticated work in race and gender in American politics. Our program will be moderated tonight by a man who will be speaking tomorrow at the Miller Center Forum at 11 o'clock in this same room. The moderator will be Douglas Blackman, who is the Atlanta Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Doug Blackman's team in Atlanta covers topics like the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and more than 1,200 companies, including some of the biggest in the world: Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Delta, Airlines, Bank of America, Wachovia, UPS, and FedEx. Mr. Blackman's stories, or the work of his bureau, have been nominated by the Wall Street Journal for the Pulitzer Prize three times. Doug has now written an important book, Slavery by Another Name: The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, about the convict labor that was rented out basically as slaves to Southern industry starting after the formal abolition of slavery. For the first time, Blackman reveals the use by dozens of U.S. corporations of the slave labor in coal mines, timber camps, factories and farms, and cities and states all across the South, beginning after the Civil War and really continuing up until the beginning of World War II. It's a special topic and gives Doug Blackman unique experience and the ability to moderate this panel tonight. So please join me in welcoming Doug Blackman.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here tonight with such an esteemed group of academics who've done such interesting scholarship, and I'm looking forward to talking more about my book tomorrow. It is Slavery by Another Name, as mentioned, and I've been accused, actually, of somehow having masterminded having a book come out with a provocative racial theme to it in this particular year. And of course, the reality is that that was completely a coincidence of missed deadlines over many years' time. But the timing of this event tonight, I think also, and I'm sure that it's actually more in response to the events of this year, but it has been fascinating for me to be out talking about my book across the country and realizing the degree to which that we are in an extraordinary moment in American history and in American discourse, both in terms of the events that are happening, and which I think the candidacy of Obama, however one perceives him or hopes what outcome they hope for, I think he's a product of the interesting times, not necessarily the cause of the interesting time that we are in. I mean, who could possibly have imagined even a few months ago, much less a year or 2 years ago, that we would end up with a presidential election in which of the four key figures in the campaign, three of them represent a constituency that we could not possibly have imagined any sort of likelihood of their presence on a national ticket such a short time ago. And so it's a wonderful time, wonderful night, despite the rain, to talk about race, gender, and American politics. So with that, I won't get in the way of the people who are far more expert than me on every aspect of those topics, and I'll turn it over to the people you know much better, who I think each are going to take a minute or two to talk a little bit about some of the kinds of work they've been doing on aspects of race and gender in politics, and then they'll have some back and forth discussion and then open it up to questions from all of you. I think we were going to begin with Professor Friedman.
This is an incredible election for all of us, but in particular for political scientists. I think earlier this year in the spring, when it looked like it was pretty clear that the Democratic nominee was going to be either a biracial man or a woman, we were just beside ourselves with excitement. There was going to be so much for us to really dig into and to study. Now, just a few months later, we have a biracial man on one ticket and a woman on the other, and it's Christmas. It's like the Yankees and the Mets in the World Series. It's just incredible. And if you're from New York, you know what I mean. I study political advertising, and one of the things that is compelling to me, and I think important about political advertising as a form of political communication, is that ads are, in an important sense, carriers of our political and cultural history. They are repositories of norms and fears and memories, and much of this concerns race and the role of race in the history, the political history of race in this country. I think about this sometimes like transatlantic cables. These forms of connection and continuity with the past that often we don't think about, right? Even if you're a fish, chances are you don't actively contemplate this connective mechanism below you, and yet they're critically important, and they form connections that can become manifest, and advertising is one way in which that happens. When I teach about advertising, and my students are familiar with this, I differentiate between the explicit message of an ad and the implicit message of an ad. The explicit message is the text, the narrative. It's easy to encounter and to make sense of. But the action is with the implicit messages. The action, the interesting, the important message of an ad is conveyed not simply through the text, the narrative, but through the images, through the sound, through the music. And the choices that have been made, deliberate choices. Very little in a campaign ad is left to chance. Almost all of it is deliberately chosen. And with that in mind, it's important to pay attention to some of the implicit messages that have implicated gender and race. There is a history in this country of some very prominent ads with important racial implicit messages, and many of you will be familiar with the famous and fabled Willie Horton ad of 1988. In 2006, the Republican National Committee ran an ad for Bob Corker in Tennessee. He was a white Republican challenging the African-American Democrat Harold Ford Jr. The ad featured, among other characters, a white woman who claimed to have met Harold at the Playboy party, and she suggested that Harold call her. The ad concluded with the text on the screen, "Harold Ford, he's just not right," and many people suggested that the implicit message was, "He's just not white." This year, we've seen, perhaps remarkably, not a great deal of explicit or implicit racial imagery or messages in campaign advertising, but it's worth noting that one of the most talked about ads, John McCain's celebrity ad, featured in an attempt to associate Barack Obama with celebrities, featured two white women who are in part famous because of their own sexuality, Paris Hilton and Britney Spears. This might have been an accident. I doubt it. Right? It might have been David Hasselhoff and William Shatner, but it wasn't. And so I'm very interested in thinking about and trying to make sense of what these implicit racial messages are, particularly in the context of this Subway Series election. Thank you.
And the Professor Weaver, I think.
A lot of you have been reading about in various news pieces, does race matter in vote choice or doesn't it? Is it just party? How does it matter? How does it matter for different demographic groups? And part of my research attempts to test that question. I use a survey experiment that looks at how white voters evaluate black candidates when they run against white candidates. And recently, you all might have seen the Stanford AP poll that came out and showed that among the Democrats and independents who weren't supporting Barack Obama, it wasn't about his race, it was doubts about his competency. And I wanted to show you all, I wanted to begin by showing you all a slide that I think suggests two things. The first, the downside, is that yes, race does matter, and that competency issues, competency evaluations of black candidates are very racially tinged. The upshot is that black candidates often have positive stereotypes that they can draw on, positive trait attributions that white voters believe to be about their candidacies. So let me show you what I mean. This is this cartoon up in the left-hand corner. It says, he's so charismatic, and look, his record is practically spotless. We've seen many cartoons like this talking about Barack Obama's lack of experience, lack of being a known quantity. And this is the striking result that I found. When the first blue bar is when a white candidate runs against another white candidate, 43.7% of people say that that candidate is more experienced. There's a significant drop-off when that candidate becomes a light-skinned black candidate, okay? And then there's the about a little bit higher on the dark-skinned black candidate there. Now, what's really fascinating about this, and what I do want to inject into this discussion, is that it's not all negative. We've been used to hearing a lot of things, you know, if race has an effect, it's necessarily going to be a negative, a net loss for the black candidate. Well, the second set of bars there indicates that actually, when asked which candidate was more hardworking, not experienced, hardworking, people were more likely to say that the percentage increased from the white candidate to the light-skinned black candidate, and further, for the dark-skinned black candidate. So I just wanted to begin by saying that race does still matter. It has a myriad number of valences. Sometimes it's negative, and that's what we like to talk about, and that's what the media tends to focus on. But sometimes it can actually be positive, and black candidates can draw on positive attributes.
Frances Sanders.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. The thing that I want to really focus on in the introductory comments that I make today is the incredible media attention to that question, well, will Obama lose the election because of race? And there are a number of different variants of this question, and one that that Veshla just mentioned came up from this Stanford AP Yahoo poll that a lot of people are talking about. I know a lot of my students noticed this poll that was released, I guess, over the weekend and picked up in the media by on Monday quite frequently. And the spin on that was, well, we've got an estimate that it's going to be 6 percentage points at least. Sometimes you see higher percentage points that people say it's going to be 15 percentage points, that Obama, simply because he's black, is going to lose the election by a figure like that. And I think it's really, really interesting how tied we are to that kind of pessimism. There's an alternative framework that we could be focusing on, which is, isn't it interesting that Obama might win this election, and looking right now like he probably will, and that we're living in a time when we have accomplished such a feat that we can have these different kinds of candidates. Let me zero in on a couple things that I've seen in the media. One of them is the commentary about the number of bigots who are still out there. So I would, when you're reading the newspaper and looking at television, I would really listen for that word, like how many bigots are left. There are some. There are fewer than there used to be, and that's one of the places where we want to lay emphasis. There are a lot of resentful white Americans people who are disturbed about the possibility that maybe black people don't work hard enough, or maybe that they get unfair attention from government. Strikingly, in that same Yahoo poll that's been getting all this attention this week, the marginals on those resentment questions that we scholars who have been working at the University of Michigan and in other places for 20, 30, 40 years on exactly this question of racial resentment, the marginals have shifted. That means lower numbers of people subscribe to the most resentful frameworks. And that idea is not one you're going to get in the media. You'll get, oh, there's still 4 out of 10 white Americans who will say negative things about blacks. It used to be 7 or 8 out of 10. And we don't hear that spin. Third point, which I think is really interesting, is the way that there's this attention to the Bradley Wilder effect. You know, this effect that's named after the mayor from California, from Los Angeles, who lost the gubernatorial election in California in 1973 because, it was a surprise because the polls had him ahead. Then our own Doug Wilder, who was predicted to win the gubernatorial election in 1989 by a bigger margin than he actually won. In 2006, when Harold Ford, the candidate who Paul mentioned when he was talking about the famous Playboy Party ad, the polling on him went the other way. He actually won by a slightly bigger margin than he was predicted to win. And that was typical in several races in 2006. A lot of people have been talking about the question of polling in the primaries. Lots of spin that there was a Bradley Wilder effect. I'm not convinced when you look at the actual data and you look at the polls, there's a lot of evidence that the Bradley Wilder effect is disappearing, and it may soon be non-existent. What does that mean? It means that we're approaching a situation where we're more comfortable in our discourse about race. There are still honest bigots, but there are also people who are sincere egalitarians. And those are some of the people who have moved us to a situation where we can be open to the possibility of having a kind of president who we have never had before. And I'm hoping that maybe we have a little more attention to that possibility and think about where the progress has been.
Professor Winner.
I'm going to talk for just a minute about my book project that I'm in the middle of, so 2 minutes to summarize a book, on the secret history of gender in American politics. And I'm interested in talking about the ways that even in through much of American political history where men were the candidates, it was men running against other men, especially at the presidential level, even in that case, gender very much structures a lot of the political discourse and political competition and how people think about that. So in some ways, this year is actually a terrible case for me because now things are explicitly with female candidates as well. But the piece of the project that I'm working on right now is looking at the gendered ways that Americans understand the political parties and their presidential candidates. And in particular, looking at data from the last 3 decades, I find that when Americans talk about why they like the Democratic Party, those who do like the Democratic Party, there are many feminine associated terms that tend to come to mind. You know, they like the party because it's compassionate, it's generous, it's egalitarian, and so forth. And conversely, they like the Republican Party for relatively stereotypically masculine characteristics. It's efficient, supports the work ethic, things like this. Turning to the candidates, Republican presidents are also liked for masculine characteristics. They're decisive, they're strong, things like this. But when we turn to Democratic presidential candidates, they are actually liked also for masculine characteristics. They're strong, they're self-confident, they're experienced politically. And so I suggest that the reason for this asymmetry on the Democratic side that we don't see on the Republican side is that our ideas about what it makes a good leader are themselves very associated with ideas about men and masculinity. And so there's a particular contrast or paradox for Democratic presidential candidates that on the one hand, they're part of a party that's got a series of feminine associations. On the other hand, they're aspiring to an office that has a series of masculine associations. And so this can, in some cases, be an advantage, others a disadvantage, but it does present a different structural terrain for Democratic presidential candidates than for Republican presidential candidates. In particular, this year, I think Barack Obama, in many ways, coming out of the primaries, was seen symbolically as a more feminine sort of image than Hillary Clinton in many ways, and certainly more feminine than McCain. And that, in this, the current environment, could actually serve him well in certain ways. In a year when there's a very unpopular war, a financial crisis that at least some are suggesting has its roots in a sort of culture of greed and recklessness run amok, having someone who is less aggressively masculine might be just the ticket for a set of Americans who, in other circumstances, want a strong leader who can stand up to our enemies. So it remains to be seen, but I just want to draw attention to the ways that gender works both in explicit ways, and certainly people's reactions to Palin versus the male candidates in the race, that matters quite a bit, but also in these more subtle symbolic ways that may go in directions that we don't expect. Thanks.
Professor Nosek.
My research group begins with the observation that people don't observe their mental operations, they only experience their output. And as a consequence, we have a lot more going on behind the scenes that our mind is doing to help us manage our everyday lives that we're not aware of. And our conscious experience is really a sliver of what is actually the processes that influence our everyday perception and judgment and behavior. One of the important things that our mind does is collect information within our environment, develop associations between people and traits, between groups and concepts, in order for us to help predict who's going to do better at what, how are things related to each other, what's going to happen in the future. And that development of associations between different groups and concepts and ideologies and political positions and people can develop whether or not we agree with those things. So we are exposed to, as Paul said in the beginning, lots of advertisements that have messages both explicit and implicit. Our minds do not decide whether they believe or disbelieve whether these associations should happen or should be stored in our minds. They're just stored. And the act of believing or disbelieving, deciding whether something is true or false, is an explicit act, is one where we are applying a corrective to the automatic or implicit associations that we might form as a consequence of being exposed to lots of different things in our environment. What we have found in our research is that people develop lots of associations that explicitly they would deny, quite honestly. 80% of people that visit our website and do our measures that don't ask you how you feel, but just measure how strongly you associate black with the concept bad more easily than white with the concept bad, for example. 80% of white Americans that come on and try this task have a stronger association of black with bad than white with bad. Suggesting that they have associations in their minds that are quite distinct from the egalitarian values that they tend to express. Likewise with gender, it's harder for people to associate female with leader or female with career than males, even if they will explicitly say, no, I'm egalitarian minded. And what we have found is that these types of associations have consequences for people's behavior. So the links to the current electoral process are obvious, and then especially to the types of messages that are prevalent in all of the other commentators, that we don't necessarily know that these things are happening, but all of these different types of processes may be playing a role in influencing how it is we orient ourselves and decide how it is we feel. We just may not realize what the sources of those feelings are.
So I guess the question is, who are we to believe? We can't believe the polls, we can't believe our minds, we can't believe our assumptions about our assumptions. That seems to be the question, though it does seem to me like there is something of a division between among the group of you, in that Professor Weaver and Sanders are suggesting that, and by the way, the Yahoo poll, I first wondered whether it was a poll by Yahoo or a poll of Yahoos. But if that's the two of you suggest that perhaps these presumptions of negative association and that affecting the way the poll results turn out or exit polls turn out, that perhaps that's not as serious or severe an issue as we tend to think. But I think Professor Friedman, his research is premised on the idea, and yours as well, I think, Dr. Winter, that that in fact those associations are so visceral and strong, and perhaps even your research, that in fact they are still very successfully preyed upon through the advertising and through these other mechanisms of politics. So how do we resolve that?
first time Lynn and I have been charged with being the racial conservatives in a room, or the racial optimists, I guess. So I'll enjoy that for a moment. I'm certainly not saying that there aren't negative racial attributions that happen. I do think that we need to question how much the Bradley effect has been overstated, how much the negative aspect of race is the thing that makes headlines, and what effect that has on perceptions, on people, on raising sensitivities, on looking for it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really interesting that the way that conservative and optimistic are associated, and liberal and pessimistic are associated, and this is a real consistent theme in this year's election. So if you praise the possibility that we have a more diverse and descriptively representative ticket, then you are somehow kind of on the thinking everything has been fixed. None of us on this panel would ever subscribe to the idea that bigotry has disappeared, that we are done with our problem of racism. But we can also kind of push the people in this room and maybe people outside of this room a little bit to think about what are the causes of the progress that we have made. It's really quite stunning to think a little more historically and think about how short a time it's been since the middle of the 1960s. So now we are in a situation where we really, American politics has been pretty white and pretty male for a long time, and compared to other countries, we look like that. And now we're changing it. What, in spite of all of these unconscious things and these terrible associations that the advertisements and the media provide for us, these pernicious kinds of things, the way we think about different people, how is it that we have managed to get past it a little bit, to get to the situation that we're in? That's something that social science has to help explain as well.
What about you, Dr. Reed? I'm sorry.
I was just going to add that I think, there's a lot of active research right now on exactly the question of how do we sort out, on the one hand, these implicit unconscious associations that we have, on the one hand, and on the other hand, explicit commitments that people hold to egalitarian values that are real as well. And I'll just point out that often, or one of the themes in this research is that those implicit and unconscious ideas don't necessarily have complete control over us, but when we aren't paying attention, aren't motivated to think carefully, and so forth, they have more power. And for many Americans, although no one in this room, politics is a domain where often they don't care all that much, they're not motivated, they're not, to spend a whole lot of time and energy thinking about it. But that when we have it pointed out to us that there might be these associations and the sorts of effects they have, and are reminded of the egalitarian values that we also hold, those can and do overwhelm or correct the sorts of implicit effects. And so in some ways, having a race with an African-American candidate that brings race out explicitly may be an opportunity. Now I'm, I guess, becoming an optimist as well, maybe an opportunity for that kind of explicit thought about the values that we hold, in addition to the sorts of less conscious or unconscious associations, that can become a bigger part of more citizens thinking about politics, with hopefully positive effects, whatever the outcome of the election, positive effects on how people bring those associations to their political thinking.
I think that's a very good point, because we aren't slaves to our automatic minds. We have consciousness, and one of the great things about consciousness is that we get to override, inhibit, adjust the types of things that we might be led to do automatically. And I think the point about real change has happened. The civil rights movement did something to what people honestly would endorse as their beliefs. So one of the sources in the context of that, one of the possibilities for race or these sorts of implicit biases to still have an impact is when we let our assumptions that race is irrelevant leave us free to say, well, race isn't impacting my choice. I have this uncomfortable feeling about this, and it must be because of this other reason, because I don't have any bias, so it couldn't be because of race, because I am now enlightened. So it must be because of this other reason that I can invent. And so it's a misattribution problem. If race is having an impact, making me a little bit uncomfortable about this decision, because I'm egalitarian-minded, I may be motivated not to attribute it to race and instead find some other reason. Oh, he's not experienced enough. He's a celebrity, and attribute it to that instead.
But all of that would argue, wouldn't it, that the effectiveness of advertising, which has some sort of specific racial strategy to it, that the effectiveness of that sort of advertising would be diminishing because of these changes in society that you're talking about. Is that the case, Dr. Friedman?
I don't know. It may be, and that's, you know, it's the ability to ask and investigate questions like that is part of what we are, what I am excited about, and that certainly, you know, you put on the table a hypothesis that makes sense, that's important, and is one that, you know, we will be looking at among the many questions that we'll be looking at after this election. I wanted to ask Nick a question, just to pick up on something that you had said earlier about suggesting that the black candidate in this election is less masculine explicitly. And I'm wondering if there's a symmetry there, thinking about Sarah Palin's candidacy. You know, for years people talked about, invoked the notion of Margaret Thatcher as the strong woman with masculine attributes, character attributes. And here we have Sarah Palin, who not only is an NRA member and not only is a hunter, but, you know, shoots these wolves and bears from helicopters. I mean, and so I'm wondering if there's, you know, if you think that that's part of her entree into, as a woman. So just to kind of move into the gender side of this.
Well, I think in many ways, yes. And so she gains some credibility as, or at least has captured the public imagination of late, in part because of these stereotypically masculine characteristics. But I'll point out, in contrast to Hillary Clinton, who of course in many ways embodied other sets of, as far as I know, she doesn't hunt moose, but other masculine characteristics, Sarah Palin also centrally presents herself as not just a woman, not just a working woman, but as a hockey mom, which is an image that gives her a base in the family, as that is who she is, and that is the base from which she is stepping out into politics. So I think she's doing, so far, a fairly nice job of capturing some of these masculine characteristics that maybe make her seem compatible with a leadership role, while on the other hand holding on to more traditionally feminine characteristics that avoid people having a sort of reaction of, oh, she's not a real woman or not sort of female enough. I'll just close that point by pointing out that hockey mom isn't just a gender image, it's also a race image. Hockey, except for maybe curling, is probably one of the whitest sports. And symbolically, it's a bit of a working class image, although it turns out that, in fact, youth hockey is very upper class because it's amazingly expensive. And it also positions her as a hockey mom as part of a heterosexual family. So it's doing work on, you know, race, class, gender, sexuality, all of these levels at once to present this amalgam that has a lot of interesting effects. How that will play out is something I'm fascinated to watch.
Let me throw out another little twist of a question. Is there a negative association with being a white male? I mean, is there a point at which the doddering old white men who read the Wall Street Journal suffer a negative? I mean, and is there a point in time that you foresee by any of these measures that at some point there's an equilibrium between the associations of negativity with white maleness, particularly older white maleness, and whatever the perceptions of negativity are with being black or a woman? Any of you? Don't make me call on someone.
I think this goes back to something I was saying about black candidates being seen as more hardworking and trustworthy and having some positive attributes. And that is, you know, Barack Obama can draw on his personal background of change. He looks like a change candidate. He can draw on that heavily, whereas McCain has a tougher time doing that. Being older, being white, while you're a known quantity, you are little less fresh, a little less, you know, you don't have that magnetism, that gravitas. However, one interesting racial development that we've noticed, Lynn and I were talking about this today, is that when racial appeals are being made, for Barack Obama to say that was a racial appeal is somehow recently he said, I might not look like the guy on the dollar bills, I might have a funny name, but to say that is somehow illegitimate, to say that race matters in this election was then charged by the McCain camp as somehow playing the race card from the bottom of the deck. And that is a new thing that we're seeing in this election as compared to when the Willie Horton ad was used. That now somehow it gives racial appeals, like the ad, the Michigan ad that some of you may have seen, that has to do with affiliating Barack Obama with Kwame Kilpatrick. And this, you know, dark-skinned man appears on the screen with these words flashing down, you know, perjury, one count of obstruction of justice, crime, crime, crime. And if you watch the ad and you don't listen to the audio, what you see is blacks, crime, Barack Obama, crime. It's a very old and familiar script. And what's dangerous about it now, and I think this is a new twist happening in this election, is that to somehow point to that and say, wait a second, that's racial. This is bringing up all the old tropes of black criminality, can now be called illegitimate, can now be called the kind of reverse playing the race card from the bottom of the deck. Mm-hmm. And that's a twist we haven't seen before.
And when that happens, that removes a really fundamental tool of democratic discourse and political change. Because if all of these things that we've been talking about are really going on, where these associations are being made through media and other mechanisms, and we can't bring it to the level of consciousness, if we can't take advantage of our conscious minds because it's trivialized, oh, you're just playing the race card, or, you know, there was a lot of it about gender too, you're just playing the gender card when there were complaints about sexist treatment in the media. That's a big, this is a tool we want to hold on to, so it's a real bad thing when that starts happening.
Speaking of ads, I just want to add one point to Vesha's account, because it's often overlooked that when Barack Obama made the comment about not looking like the other people on the dollar bills, right, and suggested they're going to say this about me, mm-hmm. and that claim was characterized as playing the race card mm-hmm. illegitimate. That came after the McCain camp had issued an ad that featured a parody of a dollar bill with Barack Obama's face on it. It didn't. He didn't make it up. Yeah. It was an actual ad.
But I would take it even a step further than that, and say that the danger is not just not bringing race to the public discourse and really wrangling over it, and having that public conversation. How is it mattering? What are our biases? How can we get beyond this? Is that a counter narrative? It opens up space for a powerful counter narrative to develop on November 5th. And that is the counter-narrative that for blacks, for young voters, for anybody that was mobilized by Barack Obama and saw this as being the first time that their constituency was being spoken to, the counter-narrative would be, if not now, then when? And if we're not, if in these conditions and having a strong, articulate, polished, black candidate that has not appeared angry or has not aligned himself with Al Sharpton, has done all of the right things, all the check marks, if not at this moment, it opens up a rift in that powerful American dream logic. It opens up a rift in the notion that this is an egalitarian society, that we can move forward together, that this moment is a moment that we can elect our first black candidate. And I personally think that that's a very dangerous moment that we might, and so that if we don't have that very public conversation now about race, the public conversation that's going to get had when we look in the mirror on November 5th is going to be a conversation that's uglier. It's going to be less, it's going to be unlovely.
Why don't we turn this out to the audience and see what they think?
Any one who has a question, and we certainly encourage questions for about the next 20 minutes, queue back here with me, and we'll do as many as we have time to do. See, the X marks the spot.
Hello, Professor Weaver, you just mentioned a couple seconds ago about a rift that might occur on November 5th, and I was wondering if you think that that rift already occurred when Hillary Clinton didn't make the ticket, and if McCain wins, has that rift already happened for women because of Sarah Palin, or if Obama wins, since there are no women on that ticket, you know, is the rift there in that case also?
This is yes coming no, from my student, Armanoush. It's a great question. And I haven't given it much thought, but I don't think that that rift already happened. And I don't think, nor do I think it was as powerful as it might be. But I'd like to hear from...
It was exaggerated, right? So it was another example of, you know, this, it was like the cat fight and the resentment of the, you know, the identity politics were made more sharp than they probably really were. In the, I mean, that is, women weren't so grumpy about Obama.
Well, and I would just add that I think whatever rift there is, and maybe that word exaggerates it, is itself amenable to the future political developments. So if, let us say, you know, Barack Obama is elected and Hillary Clinton is nominated to the Supreme Court, that changes the way people think about what happened in 2008, or if she, you know, becomes a cabinet officer, or becomes fills, you know, Ted Kennedy's role in the Senate as kind of the leader of the liberal wing of the party over the next 20 years. I mean, there are a lot of ways that politics can develop that can either reinforce that sense of disenchantment or tend to heal it. And so, you know, I would say there certainly were resentments. And what happens to those is itself amenable to political change.
I'd also just make a quick observation on that, too. As a political correspondent, that it's easy for us to forget that at the beginning of this year, in almost all of the states where you have very substantial black populations, except Illinois, that the sort of black political leadership in South Carolina, for instance, Georgia, Mississippi, all of those places were overwhelmingly behind Hillary Clinton, not behind Obama. So the traditional leadership structure just a few months ago was completely behind the white candidate, not the black candidate. And we saw that reverse so dramatically. I just think that's a reminder that this is still a fairly new thing. I could still see a pretty positive outcome, if the election is not terribly disputed. If we actually believe the outcome and Obama were to lose, and if it's perceived as him having lost fairly in some sense, and many people would not, then I think what that would set up would be another candidacy 4 years later, you know, against President McCain, and so it might not be quite the Armageddon sort of to our spirit that some people fear that it could be.
Okay. Earlier you said that the conscious mind would override our implicit association, but however, I was thinking about how that our implicit association might motivate us to seek information that would confirm our implicit association, and that would somehow kind of spill over into our consciousness, and that we actually think that we are following our conscious egalitarian mind, but actually our implicit association of black and bad might actually affect that.
Yeah, and there's certainly evidence in other domains that occurs. So if we have automatic associations that make us lean one way or another, we tend to be biased in our information search. And we know this from partisanship in general, right? Democrats tend to read articles that reinforce their beliefs that are favorable to Democrats, and they'll avoid the ones that are negative about Obama, whereas Republicans will tend to read the negative ones about Obama and the positive ones about McCain. But the same thing can be happening in a very subtle way, which is we might have associations that draw us to things that seem to feel more resonant. There is recent research coming out of laboratories that are associated with ours that shows that people who are undecided about a political issue, when they measure implicitly which way they're leaning, that actually predicts what their ultimate choice is going to be on that political topic, suggesting that they've already made a decision, they just don't know it yet. And part of what the process of coming to the decision is might be being more biased to look at information that already is consistent with our automatic reactions.
Yeah. it's just too close, Professor. I had a question for Professor Weaver and Sanders about the Bradley effect and looking at it and how come that became so mainstream in that everyone assumed that after Bradley in California and Mayor Dinkins and Governor Wilder, how come that became mainstream, even though there wasn't that much study into what actually happened and, you know, looking around the country, how many congressional candidates this happened to, how many governors did this happen to African-American candidates? Why did that become so mainstream as a given, even though it was in, it looked like, a couple isolated cases?
Yeah. It's not isolated cases. It's a real effect, and it was bigger in the 70s, a little smaller in the 80s, a little smaller in the 90s, still there, and now it looks like it's getting quite small. And I wouldn't go so far as to say it's gone, just that we're probably on the brink of it disappearing. So that's the first point. So it's a real phenomenon. It's an interesting phenomenon. I think there's almost like this kind of coalition between liberals and conservatives on this, so that it's you see in a lot of conservative commentary this idea that, well, you know, the pressures of political correctness prevent us from being able to tell what we really think, and we can only speak our minds, white people, when we get behind the, you know, get into the privacy of the secret voting booth. And so that's this kind of discrediting anything that goes on in public. And then on the other side, there's especially for sort of concepts of the donning of the black mask, the idea that that the pressures of white domination and Jim Crow make black people not able to talk about their true feelings. And certainly that was historically true. But again, it's not taking into account the process of learning to live in an integrated society. So I think we still, in the scholarship, in the media, in lots of the institutions that are quite important for us, there is this kind of coalition. And you can actually track it in the commentary by people who are self-identified on the left and the right. You see, you know, everyone's comfortable with this kind of status quo where, you know, no one can tell the truth and we can't talk to each other. And there, you know, there are newspaper articles. We can't talk about race. That's a, I guess, the New York Times 2001 or so. Or why can't we talk about it? We're very comfortable with that idea that there's no truth between people of different races.
And I think part of it is the decline of the sense that race is relevant to why I'm supporting one candidate or another. So in the surge of the civil rights movement, when there is a black candidate, race is on your mind. And you know that if I say I'm not going to vote for the black guy, that might mean that I'm racist. So I'll say that I will, even though I won't. And so the decline can be attributed to people saying, no, I'm going to support the white guy, but it's for this other reason, and not have it seem that it's race is relevant at all.
But they could also really be open.
Open. That's right.
Become a very seductive narrative because if, first of all, we have no way of predicting whether or not the Bradley effect will happen a priori, but also if it does happen and it's only 1.5 percentage points, it's only 2 percentage points, it is enough to swing an election. And that's why people are focusing on it. It didn't happen, Lynn's right, to Deval Patrick, for example, the black governor of Massachusetts. It hasn't happened in several other races where the candidate lost, but people actually said, we're not going to vote for this candidate. So it has been overemphasized, but I think the reason is that if it's only 1.5 percentage points, that might be enough.
Sorry. You often hear that this election is somehow a fluke, that the minority candidates have only been successful because of special characteristics they possess. Barack Obama is charismatic. Hillary Clinton has been in Washington and she has ties to Bill. Sarah Palin appeals to the base. And I was wondering how much truth there was to that statement and if, say, come 2016 and the slate is clean and we have a whole new set of candidates, are they going to be all white males? And is the United States going to be disappointed if they are?
I think you could come up with examples for any candidate. So how did our current president become a candidate, for example? Was that a fluke? we can generate any example, because it is amazing that anyone becomes candidate for president, because there can only be one for each party. So there are 150 million or so people that are in that party, or at least aligned with that party to some extent or another. And so how is it that one of them comes up? There's always a fluke, in my opinion.
I would totally agree. And the serial philanderer who was nominated in 1992 would be another case where you might say, who would have thought that could have happened? But I'll also point out, the longer term, so in any one cycle, yes, whoever gets nominated and then elected is a fluke, but the longer term question, to answer that more systematically, we'd want to look at things like the processes by which people are recruited into running for lower office and moving up. And it's clear that there are racial and gender effects and discrimination going on at various stages along the way where people move up the pipeline. And progress is being made, and prominent evidence of that is the flukes of this year. But over the longer term, it's continued change at that level throughout the system that really will drive a broader palette of candidates of the longer term.
And a big tactical element of the Obama success in the primaries was his ability to organize and run campaigns that were successful democratically on a scale that they hadn't been for many years, coupled with the deterioration of the Southern Republican Party. So I think there are a lot of tactical explanations that play into all of that as well, and that portend for a different future.
Hi, my name is Carolina. I'm sort of interested in the media's portrayal of Michelle Obama and the discussion of the intersection between sexism and racism in this campaign and throughout the campaign, how we've been sort of portraying, or how the media's been portraying Michelle Obama as, from anything from the Fox's baby mama to the GOP conventions, we're proud to be American, and how she's been used really to develop this unpatriotic image of Barack Obama and, using these symbols of angry black woman as dissenting, citizens of the United States. So my question sort of asks, to what extent has Michelle Obama altered, affected, or reinforced media stereotypes of black women? And to what extent is her sort of involvement in this campaign going to affect future black female political candidates?
I think to a great extent she's been she's been a target in a way that her husband has not been. I think that she's been a lightning rod of sorts and has received some of the more explicit or more familiar kinds of stereotyping and accusations and charges and rhetoric that Barack Obama has been able to escape in all of the ways that we've been talking about tonight. And I think, the parody that was that now famous New Yorker cartoon spoke directly to that. It spoke to both of them, of course, but in the discussion about that New Yorker cartoon, so much of it was focused on her because she was, it was more pronounced. It was a stronger set of images and a stronger set of stereotypes.
Yeah, and building on that, I would say that we have stereotypes about race, but then we also have very powerful stereotypes about subtypes within racial categories. And so in particular, the image of the angry black woman, that's race, gender, and a sort of emotional tinge as well. And the angry black man is a stereotype that I think Obama is working very hard to avoid, which is why he is not able to, or avoids sort of pointing out racial attacks that he might think are there. But I think because Michelle Obama, is not as well known, she's not the candidate, so she's not speaking and in ads as much, stereotypes play a relatively larger role in people's perceptions. And so Obama, as he gets better known and as she gets better known, I'm sure they're working very hard to counter exactly those sorts of stereotypes. And I think, her convention appearance and her speech was very much geared toward, avoiding any kind of sort of anger or anything that could cue those sorts of images. And, her with the kids on stage was all, very carefully thought out with exactly those sorts of issues in mind. So.
I would just also mention she played an early role in the campaign when there was lots of questions about Barack Obama's authenticity among blacks, right? Is he black enough, or was he just Harvard educated, biracial, you know, most of the family he grew up with was white. She stepped in and was a key mobilizer for the black community. And you saw things in the black press like, you know, she's not a white woman. He didn't marry a white woman, and it might have been different had she been lighter skinned, had she been white. So it's an interesting kind of flip side of the way she actually helped mobilize the black electorate to get behind Barack Obama early on when questions were being raised.
Good evening. My name is Frank. And I guess I've had a lot of discussions with, you know, some roommates and friends over the whole idea that, you know, blacks are just voting for Obama simply because he is black and that he would promote and protect, you know, black interests, or whether blacks should vote for Obama because he's the right candidate. And so I guess I just want to solicit your views on what you think about that, and I guess how that will affect, you know, the black vote and, you know, white perception of the black vote.
I think black people will vote for Barack Obama for both reasons. Probably not, I mean, he's not a candidate who is running on a platform of trying to promote black interests specifically. He's black people are quite attentive, I think, when you look at electoral history and you look at some of the patterns of change in party allegiances, quite attentive to economic issues in particular, and I think that that's going to be something that becomes increasingly important as we watch the whole American financial system unravel. And so that's that will be a big part of his appeal to the all the people who end up voting for him, and especially to black people. We tend to when we think about the way that the patterns of overwhelming support from the black community for Barack Obama, we forget how overwhelming the support for Democratic candidates tends to be anyway. Now, that's not to discredit the shifts and the, you know, there are marginal differences from election to election, but in general, black people have been voting Democratic, and so why do we get so focused on the possibility that they might be voting because of race when we should expect that they're voting on the basis of their party allegiance?
I agree with all of what Lynn was saying. Just to add a little bit to that, Colin Smith, who's a grad student in the lab, has been doing some data collection on the implicit biases about the about this election and preferences for Obama and McCain. And the group that appears to be most divided of themselves are black Republicans. They show much more conflict, at least in terms of being relatively equivalent in their liking for the two candidates, than any other subcategory that you can generate, which is an interesting phenomenon in itself.
How many did you find?
Yeah, six. Yeah.
Oversampling.
Well, we do this online, so anybody can come and do. We get 20,000 people a week coming and doing tests at our website, so we end up with a five.
But there's also another thread of explanation in the, you set up you posited two possibilities of voting for blackness or voting for the right candidate, but there's also the factor of the sense of history. And I think that clearly demonstrated itself in the movement of support among African-American voters during the primaries, where younger African-Americans early on attached themselves to Obama. You could ask that question about them more precisely than you can about older African-Americans, but as you approach the South Carolina primary in particular, and you had figures like John Lewis who were absolutely in the camp of Hillary Clinton, began to realize that they were on the wrong side of history, and how could they find themselves left behind when such a momentous event was about to occur, and then there was a second windfall of sorts that came from that.
Doug, I think we have time for two more questions.
I'm Rachel Pierce. I was wondering, you guys have been talking about sort of Sarah Palin as a hockey mom. You brought that up. And one of the interesting things that I've found with Obama's campaign has been the deployment of Michelle Obama. And, you know, I was just kind of wondering about what you thought about the increasing centrality of family in these elections, and, you know, whether not just in terms of image, but in terms of talking about inequalities, that Michelle Obama is a way of talking about race without Obama playing the race card. And so I was wondering sort of what you guys thought about that and whether actually that's more beneficial for male candidates than it is for female candidates, just in terms of, you know, traditional family structures. And
I'll engage in a stereotype. I mean, I think lots of male politicians don't attend to their families very much, and we think of political kids as just they're going to get wrecked, and we think that's just going to, we just take that as something that we expect. It's kind of normal, and it would be interesting if the focus on family, which I think you're right, Rachel, to observe that's going on in a particularly pronounced way for both of the candidates who are not white men. What if we started to utilize that criteria for evaluating the competency, experience, genuineness, trustworthiness of some of the candidates who I mean, what if we were really to go there and make those judgments? Maybe we would be violating privacy, but maybe we would be looking at an area where a new way to sort of open our evaluations about some other people.
And I'll just add, I completely agree. And I'll just add that there's a tradition going back literally to the founding in our country of women's political role being rooted explicitly in their family position, this ideal of Republican motherhood. My students were talking about it with me today, so I have it on the mind. But it was all about women's political position being based on their role as mothers, socializing their sons and socializing their husbands to enter politics as virtuous citizens. And so I think that does set up now an expectation, or at least the remnants of that, an expectation that female candidates will both be political and have the right stands and be effective as politicians, but also be effective as mothers in a way that I think fathers can get away with being lousy fathers if they're good at the politics. And so, you know, we might hope that at the very least that those sets of standards about family either are taken as indicators for candidates of all sorts, or left as private matters for everyone.
Hi. The role of sexuality was mentioned earlier on the panel, so my question has to deal with Defense of Marriage Acts that are on the ballot in California, Arizona, and Florida, and what role the historically more conservative minority groups, such as the African-American community and the Latino community in California, will have in determining whether or not these initiatives will pass?
I'm sorry, I just want to jump in, because as it happens, my brother is doing his history dissertation on questions very related to that. And one point he makes, so I'll take it as my own, is that though African-Americans are, on average, somewhat more conservative on traditional morality issues, and such as approval of homosexuality, they're actually less supportive of things like ballot initiatives to limit equal rights, especially if they're framed in equal rights terms, for a set of reasons we can imagine having to do with analogies to the civil rights movement. So I think it's actually a myth that those ballot initiatives will, you know, pull out or push African American or other conservative minority citizens to vote more conservatively than they might. So I think it's more complex to figure out exactly how that'll play out, but that image doesn't capture everything that's going on there.
Doug, I have sort of three quick announcements. First, there will be pizza downstairs in our common room, pizza and soft drinks. And I'm going to apologize up front. A lot more people came out than we anticipated. So if we don't have enough for everyone, please forgive us and come back and give us another try when we will try to do better planning. We have a drawing for a autographed copy of Doug Blackman's book, and Christina Lopez Guittardi has the tickets here, and an absolute random student will draw the tickets out.
All right. Kate Healy
gets a free copy of the book.
No screen.
Wheels of joy.
This event was suggested by Sally Bury of the College of Arts and Sciences magazine, and we are delighted on behalf of the Miller Center to partner with the College of Arts and Sciences in presenting this great panel. To our panelists and to Doug Blackman, who will be signing copies of his book out front here as soon as we're over, let me say thank you very much.
Thank you.